Hello, I'm Robina Courtin in San Francisco. We're organising an amazing conference here for November, the 24th and 25th. It's called Happiness and Its Causes at happinesssf.com. We've got 40 of the best minds sharing breakthrough ideas about the very meaning of happiness and how to achieve it. Speakers include Paul Ekman, one of the 100 most eminent psychologists of the 20th century, Cambridge philosopher Thupten Jinpa, the Dalai Lama's principal translator, Anne Harrington, Harvard University's professor of the history of science, Melissa Matheson, award-winning screenwriter of Kundun and E.T., and Google's jolly good fellow, Meng. Also, we're offering continuing education units to therapists, nurses, and social workers in California. So please, join us in San Francisco, November 24 and 25, and learn how to create more happiness in your life, your work, and your relationships. Register now at happinesssf.com.
Welcome to Make Me Happy, the happiest happy hour you've ever been at. My name is Amy Koje.
And this is Dr. Bob Nozick. Hi, Amy.
I am so happy. Thank God it's Friday.
Yes, it is. And very, very soon to join me in the doctor title.
Very
it's really
soon.
It's going to only be a couple
the
more
final
weeks,
countdown.
Don't you think? Hello there.
I was playing a practical joke on you.
Oh, you were? Well, what the heck?
Isn't
I guess thank
April
God it's Friday.
If you can't laugh at yourself, who can you laugh at?
Well, that's right. Laughing at yourself is where it starts.
Absolutely. Dr. Bob, this study that you forwarded me was amazing.
Yeah, this is a very recent study put out by the University of Maryland. And the title is Unhappy People Watch TV and Happy People Read and Socialize.
I don't think it's a very big shocker, actually.
Well, I guess not. You know, the only thing is that sometimes, you know, we make assumptions, and those assumptions don't happen to pan out. This time, the assumption did. You know, it just seems like intuitively that people who just sit around watching TV all the time are going to be less happy than those that are out doing other things like socializing.
Right. I thought maybe they would have exercise on here, too. Read, socialize, and exercise.
Well, you know, that might be also in there. It's just that they didn't study that, that's all. They probably just included a couple of variables in their study. You know, after all, this is a huge, huge study, and it's kind of retrospective, I guess. I don't have the original article here, but a report from the university, but it analyzed 30 years of national data from Time Use Studies, and it involved a huge number, 30,000 people. So this is a massive amount of data, but I'm sure they couldn't control what factors were looked at over all those years.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that they're predicting that there's going to be a huge increase in television viewers due to all the layoffs going on around now. And so people are going to be laid off watching TV more and therefore become more unhappy.
Well, you know, that's the issue. Now, that's one thing I don't believe that they were able to decide. Is it that watching TV makes you unhappy, or does being unhappy make you watch TV?
Do, 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 do. Well,
yeah, as far as I know, they weren't able to separate that that issue out, so we don't really know. But one of the interesting things is that they found that spending time watching television may contribute to viewers' happiness in the moment, but a less positive effect in the long run. And that certainly sounds like the kind of happiness that you and I talk about as being hedonic happiness. That is
right.
The kind that just is there for that moment, but then leaves and goes away.
Right. In fact, it says right here, the TV habit may offer short-run pleasure at the expense of long-term malaise.
Yeah, and I think that does make sense to me, at least. I have to say that, you know, watching TV is easy and it's hypnotic. You can turn on the TV and then you kind of sit there and instead of selectively saying, oh, here is a show I really want to watch it, and then go off and go read or socialize, I think it's so easy to just flip it on, sit there, and whatever comes on, there you are. You know, it doesn't matter. It's not selective.
Yeah. Well, I actually haven't watched television in many years.
I know. It's a little unfair, of course, because you decided not to own a TV. So you're not.
Well,
you won't
be seduced.
Well, I'm a happy
person, so obviously I'm out reading and socializing.
Absolutely. But I do think it's interesting because, given all that, that I know that you're very interested, once you've moved on to past simply getting your PhD, I know you're very interested in actually working up a TV show on happiness.
Well, look, my target audience is unhappy people, and here we are looking at a study that proves that unhappy people watch TV.
Absolutely, and you've got a built-in audience. I mean, what better than that? The people you want to access will be there waiting for you.
Yeehaw! Yes, I'm really looking forward to creating a reality show that teaches the audience how to live a happier life.
Yeah, that's right. It's interesting here, too, because it says that, and this is absolutely, I think, sound, unhappy people were also more likely to feel they have unwanted extra time on their hands. That reminds me of a phrase that I think is just deadly called killing time. I mean, time is perhaps the most precious commodity we have, and yet the phrase killing time is so popular, and here unhappy people have excess time. It gives me another quote opportunity to make a quote from Ben Franklin, who said, if you want to get something done, ask a busy person. And here it is again, you know. These people are just lying around killing time and not getting anything done.
Honestly, I can't relate to people who have that experience.
Certainly being in a PhD program would make that unrelatable.
Not for much longer! So, Bob, who is our guest today?
Oh, this is going to be really fun. I'm really excited to introduce our guest, Elizabeth Sloan. Elizabeth is a licensed professional counselor in three states, Maryland, Virginia, and the District of Columbia. She is a clinical member of the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. And she has a master's degree in marriage and family therapy from, guess where, the University of Maryland, just where we had our article that we discussed today.
Amazing.
What a coincidence, huh? Her master's project was on improving communication in couples. She has been in private practice for 19 years providing couples and family counseling. Her practice specializes in preparing couples for marriage, rebuilding relationships after an affair, or, and this one is interesting, sign of our times, online infidelity, recovering as a couple from the effects of sex or love addiction, improving couples' ability to communicate effectively, and moving couples up the happiness scale through Accentuate for Couples, her model of helping couples remember positive feelings and use skills that are known to build strong, happy relationships. In addition to running her private practice, Elizabeth has served as past clinical director of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, the primary association for psychiatrists who treat children and adolescents with mental health disorders. She was instrumental in developing the Academy's practice parameters, documents that describes best practices in diagnosing and treating disorders in children and adolescents. She is also past senior director of outcomes, research and quality improvement at Magellan Health Services, a national behavioral health care company. She created and managed national programs in quality improvement, research into effectiveness of mental health treatments, prevention of depression and other mental health disorders, and clinical practice guidelines, development, and monitoring. Before her training as a marriage and family therapist, Elizabeth held editorial and reporting positions for newspapers and magazines. She specialized in articles on health, science, and mental health topics. And this is interesting. She first realized she wanted to work with couples and families in the 1980s when she was hanging around Dubrovnik in the former Yugoslavia with nothing much to do.
Killing time.
She didn't sit back and watch television. But what she did was wandered into an international meeting of family therapists taking place in English. She was hooked on family therapy's emphasis on building strengths and applied for graduate school when she returned to the U.S. She has helped hundreds and hundreds of couples and families and is happy to say she gets holiday cards from families saying things like, "Thanks for saving our marriage. Without you, this family photo would not be possible." She can be reached through her website, Caring Couples Happy Lives, at www.caringcouples, that's one word, caringcouples.com. Elizabeth, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, it's a delight to have you.
I can hear your deep inner contentment already just by a few words.
Well, contentment is something we carry with us or not, and I think we could all agree we're much happier when we have it.
Absolutely. Elizabeth, can you just start us off right off the bat with the connection between relationships and happiness?
I sure can. It turns out that having a good relationship is one thing that differentiates the very, very happiest people, those in the top 10% of happiness. A stable, committed, fulfilling, romantic relationship, it just trumps a good job, a fat bank account, living in a sunny climate. It's just way, way, way far and above every other dimension that people might have thought has something to do with happiness.
Well, that the other side of that has got to be true too. Having been married and divorced twice, having things go bad, I would think must relate to unhappiness.
Oh, it sure is, Bob. You know, the thing that I hear over and over is, "But we used to be so happy." You know, what starts out as a source of joy for people becomes really a source of discouragement and pain. And in fact, if you're in an unhappy relationship, it significantly lowers your overall happiness. And, you know, people end up showing signs of depression. Their self-esteem is lower. They feel like they can't do anything. They're disempowered. It's even bad for your health. I mean, if at age 48, if a man or woman is in a stable, long-term relationship that's happy, that fact alone can predict whether they'll even be alive at age 65.
Wow.
So it's pretty important.
That is really impressive.
What about after a spouse has infidelity?
Well, that's a really good point, too. And, you know, the good news about infidelity, if there could be such, is that infidelity in a couple can actually be the harbinger of kind of a new day dawning for a couple. People think that sex is the most common reason why someone would have an affair. It actually turns out that emotional neglect is really what it's about. People get caught up in their lives. They focus on kids, job, housework, the whole nine yards, and they often think, well, the relationship isn't doing that badly. Maybe I don't have to put my attention there. That can breed feelings of, you never pay attention to me anymore. You're too busy for me. By the time we get to bed, you're exhausted. And this kind of chronic lack of attention seems to be the Achilles heel in a marriage. People will turn to someone else who will think they're fantastic and will listen to them and give them attention and praise. All the things that we know build good relationships and are probably there at the beginning of a marriage, but then can fall away over time.
Isn't there a certain degree of irrational expectation as well that some people carry into marriage, that the extremely romantic beginning, feeling that should continue on year after year, as opposed to moving on to a more to the warmer but quieter aspects of a successful marriage?
Well, that's a really, really interesting question, because in fact what I find is somewhat the opposite, that people can expect to have romance and passion in their relationship indefinitely. It's not an unrealistic expectation. And some couples do this naturally. We call them the master couples. They somehow know the secret to keeping a relationship vital. And a vital relationship produces, as we said earlier, lots and lots of happiness. It doesn't go away over time.
So what are the secrets to keeping it a happy relationship?
Well, Amy, it has to do with avoiding the negative cascade that happens in couples that I was alluding to earlier. You know, couples start out feeling like they're soulmates. Nobody puts a personal ad in the paper or online saying, I'm looking for a selfish, self-centered, critical, lazy, emotionally unavailable jerk. You know, we always say, you know, we want somebody great, and we want to create a great relationship and a happy future. And this is, you know, the soulmate phase. People feel as though this person knows them better than anyone on the planet, and they can, you know, talk all night and not even notice the time going by, and the sex is fantastic. It's wonderful. We smile, we gaze. We can't keep our hands off of each other. It's just a very sweet time. But what happens is people go from soulmates to roommates. If the relationship actually works, they stay together, then guess what? They have more responsibility. They have more stress. Real life starts to intrude. And so what started out as this great pocket of joy and bliss in their otherwise, you know, normal lives starts to become normal, and like everything else. It doesn't help that we're fighting the hedonic treadmill. The first bite of ice cream is perfect, but the second bite is only 60% as good, the third is only 20% as good, and the fifth, you might as well not even try. You put it away, you'll be better off. That hedonic treadmill works in relationships, too, because things that were rewarding at first, that really got our brain juiced up, now don't quite do it as much for us, unless we put a lot of energy into it, which I'll talk about later. So a lot of the glow leaves the relationship, and then life intrudes, and people start disappointing each other because we're focused on things that, you know, the fires we have to put out. We're not there for our partner. At first, when the phone rang, we'd run to get it, hoping it was that wonderful magic person. And now when the phone rings and it's your loved one, you say, oh, I can't talk right now. I'm sorry. Can I call you back later? And that's disappointing. So people can actually end up going from roommates to cellmates, as in, you know, jail cell, where they have stopped feeding each other, they have stopped nourishing each other emotionally, and what they actually end up connecting about is all the negatives. And so this is where this is where they start to get really into trouble, and that's where they have to do something.
I've been interested in a question that comes up a lot, whether you believe that it is viable or even possible to for married couples to have friends, close friends of the opposite sex.
Oh, that's a very good question, and, you know, I hear that all the time in my practice. And there's a concept that I'm going to borrow from a woman named Shirley Glass, whose book is called Not Just Friends. I highly recommend it. She has a term called a friend of the marriage. So if either partner has an opposite sex friend or another friend that could possibly be a romantic interest, that friendship has to withstand the test of, can I look your mate in the eye and know that everything is okay and on the level? You know, if the person is a friend of the marriage, they are not only a friend of one of the partners, but they're involved in the social life of that family or that couple. You know, they're not a secret. It's not a place where the person, the spouse or the person in the committed relationship, can sort of divert energy and divert, you know, tell secrets, talk about their day, talk about their deepest dreams, their fondest hopes, or complain about their spouse. That is not a healthy friendship for a marriage or a committed relationship. And so, you know, if that third party can be embraced and a healthy part of the relationship, they can actually add a lot.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that. I think that so often jealousy gets in the way. Can you talk a little bit about how we can remove jealousy or manage the jealousy that comes up in a couple?
Sure. Amy, when, you know, let's take out people who might be jealous no matter what, okay? There are some people who struggle with that, but generally people who don't start out as jealous types can become jealous because they do see time and energy and even money going to some other person when, in fact, they have a very legitimate claim to it. And so, you know, their jealousy is really, when you really get down to it, it's a protest. It's an attempt to say, hey, wait a minute, what about me? How could you be, you know, I'm trying to reach you and you're looking toward that other person and those gifts that used to come to me, I can no longer get. I can't even really get you. And sometimes it's hard for people to acknowledge how angry they are at their partner for putting them in that position. And it's sometimes easier and less threatening to start disliking the third party. So it's kind of a difficult position all around until people start to regather, and the people who are in a committed relationship have to sort of bolster the walls around their relationship. There's the concept of walls and windows. You don't want the relationship to be surrounded by windows because energy can leak out, resources can leak out, and you don't want a wall between the partners where information doesn't get back and forth. Love and affection, they don't get back and forth between the partners. You want to put a window between the partners and a wall around the relationship.
I'm interested in how you feel about non-monogamy. I actually know quite well several couples who practice non-monogamy and are very happy doing it and have done it for many years. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's very interesting, and I certainly think that we as social scientists have not answered every question about the kinds of relationships that work. And I can't really speak to non-monogamous relationships they really don't work with them. Maybe what you're telling me is that they're so happy they're never going to come to a couples counselor. I don't know. It's a nice thought. And yet, you know, human beings are so complex, and no two are alike. And so I can totally imagine that some people would be able to maintain that kind of a relationship and feel as though their lives are enhanced by it.
Well, you know, that's such a great answer, Elizabeth, because I was, you know, most people that work in fields like yours just out of hand reject it as anything that could conceivably work, and yet I think you've spotted the problem with that kind of a conclusion, and that is that they don't see them, you know?
So, it would make a great study.
Yep, it would.
So how would couples make up after fighting to keep their happiness?
Well, you know, Amy, I think a lot of people in a happy relationship or even a moderately happy relationship can bounce back after an argument. We call those repair mechanisms. So, you know, you and your partner might have had a really awful discussion about your checkbook or your credit card balance, and it didn't go so well. You don't like how you were, and you don't like how your partner was. But after you, you know, go off and cool off and think about it with a cooler head, you can come back to your partner and go, you know, that wasn't the best conversation. We didn't get anywhere. I was a little unreasonable. Let's try it again. And they can go have the conversation they should have had but couldn't. A lot of it has to do with being able to own a piece of the problem. You know, someone can say, you know, I really am a little hard-headed when it comes to our credit debt level. You know, I think that there is no such thing as a good credit balance, and I will not, you know, I can't handle it, even a $500 charge on there. So the person is owning their part of the conflict and sort of holding out an olive branch. What's more troubling, I mean, a lot of people can do this, but what's more troubling and more serious is when people can't bounce back. In other words, the relationship has suffered so many insults over time, that negative cascade has gotten a hold of the couple, where it's gotten to the point where you do not nourish and feed me and my happiness and my dreams, and now I'm not going to feed you either. And so when that goes on long enough, people get into a state of mind where they can't actually have positive thoughts about their partner or about their relationship at all anymore. When couples come to me to try to recover from a difficult relationship, or some event like an affair that has caused a lot of pain, the first thing I do is ask, you know, of all the two people in the world, what brought you guys together? How did you fall in love? And how did you end up wanting to be together for the rest of your lives? And you know, some people can say, oh, yeah, I can remember like it was yesterday. I looked across the room, and there she was, and our eyes locked. And I said, this is the person I'm going to be with forever. But for other people, they stammer, they look down, they can't think of a good reason or anything positive about their partner, even when they first met. And they'll say things like, well, you know, it was about that time for me. I hadn't dated anyone in a while, and he came along, and he seemed like a nice guy, but, you know, I sort of drifted into it. They can't really seem to remember anything positive, and yet, as we said earlier, there were positive things. They very likely were happy and thrilled and excited about this person and this relationship early on. And so what they need is they need a little extra help to get back to their ability to feel positive feelings and think positive thoughts about their partner and start turning the relationship around to where it can be a source of happiness and joy and light.
You know, Elizabeth, they often talk about how opposites attract, and yet when people who are very opposite get together long term, they begin to say to themselves, how can they function that way? What do you think about that? Is the best match opposites or similars?
Well, there actually was some research that came out recently about that. Maybe you have heard of the Myers-Briggs type indicator.
Oh, yeah.
And the question has always been, does two types that are really far apart on the Myers-Briggs end up being, attracted to each other and happy over the long term? Well, the research suggests that actually people who have more similar outlooks and styles end up being happier over the long term. Mm. So opposites may attract, but I don't know if they stay together.
Can you talk about your theory of accentuating for couples?
I would love to. So, one of my favorite songs, it's as hokey as they come, but it's just a delight, is the old song from 1944, Accentuate the Positive. If you guys don't play it, I don't know who would, but I so recommend it. It's just wonderful. And
how does it go? Can you sing it?
You gotta accentuate the positive. Eliminate the negative.
Mm-hmm.
You know the one I mean, right?
Absolutely.
So I use this model with couples that you want to accentuate the positive. We know from all of the positive psychology findings that have been coming out over the past 10 years that we have so much power to drive our reality, to drive our everyday existence. That's especially true in couples because the couples are so sensitive to our changing moods and outlooks. So what my model does is tries to help people integrate the positives and the negatives so that they can find their way back to that beginning phase, the soulmate phase. Because when people have had enough time being unhappy and feeling unnourished in a relationship, the part of their brain that holds that negativity, that's the part that they have access to, and it kind of overwhelms the part of their brain that holds those positive long-term memories of who that person was that they're together with, the things they admired and loved, and the wonderful experiences they had together in the beginning. So what we have to do, and we know a lot about this because of the decade of the brain, that, we have these things called brain states, and they can grab a hold of us. We can get into an angry brain state, and in that moment in time, all we can remember is everything that makes us angry in the world. And so what we have to do is get these negative brain states inside of a person's mind to communicate with the longer-term positive brain states that used to have a hold of their mind but have gotten buried. And one thing that we know can help with this is called bilateral stimulation. And that sounds complicated, but really what it means is we want to light up one side of our brain and then the other side of our brain and alternate them back and forth, back and forth. It's a lot like what happens when we're sleeping. We have rapid eye movement sleep, REM sleep, and that's a period of time in which our brains are processing information at a very, very high rate. So a high rate of information quickly, a lot of things get resolved. We take short-term memories, we analyze them, we get perspective on them, and we store them as long-term memories. The thing is that in a relationship that has not been going well for over time, it's so upsetting that our brains can't keep up with processing the negatives and getting perspective and coming out on the other side of, okay, well, this isn't perfect, but it's okay. What we have to do is give the brain some help. So there are several things that we do. First of all, we try to help people go back and remember the positives from the beginning of the relationship. So we ask them, you know, can you tell me about the first time that you had sex? Can you tell me the first time that your partner said, I love you? Can you tell me about your wedding day if you're a married couple? Can you tell me about the day that you found out you were pregnant, if you're parents? These are usually, you know, times in our lives that have a lot of positivity attached to them. So for some people, they can kind of get back there if they concentrate hard enough. But for other people, we have to use bilateral stimulation. So what we'll do is we'll have them remember the day that they first said, I love you. And we will have them, you can do this yourself. Anybody can give themselves bilateral stimulation. And it's wonderful for amplifying positive feelings. Just take your hands and put one on each knee and tap one knee and then the other, and one and then the other, back and forth, back and forth. That's bilateral stimulation. You're lighting up one side of the brain and then the other. So if you take a positive memory or a positive emotion and you use bilateral stimulation with yourself, you can really increase your sense of that memory or emotion. So that's what we're doing. We're helping them remember positives and then strengthening those positives. Some people can't even remember anything positive, so we have them go back and look at photos and read emails or letters from times when they first were together. They might even talk to a friend or family member and say, you know, remember when I met so-and-so? What was going on? What was I telling you I liked so much about him? So, you know, we collect these memories however we can, and we strengthen them using bilateral stimulation. But that's not enough. That's a good start, but it's not enough to really get everything done we need to have done. The second thing we need to do, now that we've built up a little positive energy again, is really try to understand things that don't go right when we interact with our partner. Those negative interactions that seem to happen over and over. I'm sure you know couples, and they say, we have the same fight over and over. We never get anywhere. We end up sweeping it under the carpet, but then we have it again later. It's a kind of like negative cycle they just can't get through. So what we do is we have them understand what happens to them when they're in that negative cycle with their partner and what skills they need to learn, what positive skills they need to learn so that they have better choices for each at each point. You know, when they see their partner giving them a dirty look, well, what do they do in reaction to that? You know, what happens inside of them? What can they do that's better? So John Gottman, the couples researcher, who's probably the premier couples researcher in the country, who's at the University of Washington in Seattle, he talks about the master couples who are so good at handling conflict that squabbles look like fun. I always say to couples, you know, what you have to do is you have to learn how to be Irish, because it's said that an Irishman can tell you to go to hell in a way that makes you want to go. So it's kind of like changing your steps in the dance, and then the other person really wants to cooperate with you. That's being a master couple. So what we do is we help them to find things in the moment to appreciate and use affection and humor to diffuse tension and to avoid the four horsemen of the marital apocalypse: defensiveness, criticism, contempt, and withdrawal. So we identify these things that they shouldn't be doing, and we give them replacements that will help them through. And what we then do is we have them use visualization. They can actually see themselves in this negative interaction with their partner using their positive skill and using the positive feelings that go along with how they felt about the person early in the relationship, and then visualizing a new outcome. And what we add is bilateral stimulation that really anchors it and amplifies the positives. And we rehearse and we rehearse. We make a mental videotape until it feels as though, hey, you know, I've got my lines down. I know what I'm going to do. And I can feel really good about this.
That was a great explanation of that process. And I'm glad you mentioned humor, because I'm a great believer in the use of humor as a wonderful defuser. But humor has to be used properly, doesn't it? I mean, humor oftentimes is cutting or has an object of scorn to it. Could you say some more about humor and the use of humor?
Absolutely. Some people are just geniuses at humor. When Martin Seligman and Chris Peterson were coming up with the 24 strengths and virtues that seem to be universal, that everyone appreciates, humor is one of them, and some people are just a genius at it. It is probably something that's a little hard to learn, because it's got to do with timing and nuance and being able to really feel the mood of a room or a person or a relationship. But you're absolutely right. There's bright humor and there's dark humor. If humor at the expense of anyone is probably not really humor. It's really criticism or sarcasm. Good humor is the kind of thing that lifts everyone's boat. The tide comes in and everyone's lifted. It's kind of hard to say exactly what constitutes it, because it's very context-dependent. You know, what could be a really hilarious joke and have everyone in pieces in one context would just not work in another. I always think my yardstick is open-heartedness, because when people are very open-hearted, when we say something, we can feel how it's going to impact someone else. So if we throw a dart, we actually kind of feel the pain in our own heart. So if I'm going to say something that I think is funny, and if I feel pain, I know it wasn't really funny.
Pain in the heart. I read that, I'm not sure if you've read that book called The Female Brain by Luann Bridenstine. And in that book, she talks about how the sex center in the male brain is the same size as the emotional center in the female brain, and the female's sex center is the same size as the male emotional center. And so I've come to understand that, you know, we as women, we go through different cycles in our brain chemistry, where we are more feeling like nurturers, or we're more feeling like romantic lovers. And so we have this, you know, ebb and flow and growth throughout our lifespan, according to Luann Bridenstine. And so I know that in some couples, the woman in particular goes through times, maybe even years, where she's just not interested in having sex. Now, to me, from what I understand, is that would be like asking a man to not have sex would be like asking a woman to not feel her emotions. Can you talk about that?
I sure can, and I'm glad you raised that. It is a very common situation that couples find themselves in. And I think different researchers would probably have different points of view on this, but my point of view is, marriage or a committed relationship is an agreement. It's an agreement to be what we can be as a gift for the other person. It's more of a giving than it is a taking. It's more of a gift than it is a contract. So if we know, and I think most people do know, that women really like to feel emotionally connected, and men really like to feel sexually connected, although it's a little bit of a stereotype, but I do think our brains tend us toward those directions. Then I think if people want to be in a happy relationship, they can stretch themselves. They can continually choose to move toward the center. You know, we're not going to turn men into women or women into men, and why would we want to? But what's wrong with inching over to the other person's way, if only to increase their happiness and joy in living and their sense of being loved? With my couples, I often borrow from Gary Chapman, who has a wonderful concept called love languages. And he's identified 5 love languages. And the idea behind this is that you give love in the language in which your partner prefers to receive love. So if you're the kind of person who likes gifts, if your partner gives you a gift and that makes you feel loved, oftentimes you'll think, well, I ought to give my partner a gift because that's what love means. Well, your partner may not feel loved by having a gift. Your partner may feel loved through physical touch. So, you know, people can often expend a lot of energy trying to show love to their partners and not even realize that their partner's missing the message. So if we identify those ways that our partner likes to be loved and we put our energy there, we can definitely set in motion a positive cycle of more joy, more happiness, more connection. And I say that because, you know, women really frequently say, if my partner would just sit down and listen to me and talk with me, I would just feel so loved. And men frequently say, if my partner would just touch me, if she would show me physical affection, even if it doesn't lead to sex, I just want to feel held and hugged and kissed and teased, you know? Roll up the kitchen towel and whack me on the behind with it. I think that would be really great. It would make me feel loved. I don't think there's anything wrong with us trying to identify what our partners want and giving it to them.
Elizabeth, I wouldn't want to go through the hour without raising something that's very controversial, and perhaps you've been aware that out here in California we had a proposition banning gay marriage that just went through. And feel free to avoid answering this if you'd rather, but I wonder what your opinion about that is, and also have you had in your practice experience with gay couples?
Okay, well, yeah, it is a very difficult question, and I can't say that I know enough about it to give an educated answer. But I can say that I intensely dislike intolerance as a general rule. As I said earlier, people are very complex and varied, and we haven't been able to decide, you know, the one perfect way that people can be happy. To be perfectly honest, John Gottman, the researcher up in Seattle who knows so much about couples through some of the best studies that we've ever had, has found that same-sex couples are much happier than heterosexual couples as a general rule. That many of the things we're trying to teach heterosexual couples that, you know, result in happy relationships, same-sex couples just kind of do already. So how can we say, you know, I can't say, I don't know, but the literature says that same-sex couples, you know, can be very, very, very happy and have a leg up on heterosexual couples. What should be done politically, I'm afraid that is just so far out of my range that I wouldn't begin to know how to answer it. But intolerance and cruelty are never called for.
Very good and wise answer.
I'm very fascinated by that research study. That's so interesting that gay couples are actually happier than hetero couples, and that hetero couples should model themselves after gay couples. That's quite a thought I haven't had before, and it's interesting to see that we have research to support that. But then you just brought up, violence, and I'm wondering, in a happy relationship, of course we all want to have a happy relationship, but what are some indicators of an unhealthy relationship that may be beyond repair of a particular, level of happiness, and maybe better to go separate ways?
You're right, Amy. Not every couple can be saved, as not every relationship can be saved, and not every two people should be together. Sometimes people have to go pretty far off course to wake up and start doing the right thing. However, if there's violence, if there's any kind of harmful behavior that clearly endangers people in any way, and if the person doing that refuses to do better, do a better job at handling themselves, then, of course, we have to put safety before everything. Some of the most heartbreaking couples that I work with are people who love each other so intensely. You can feel it in the room. The love is so strong, but they can't be together because one or both of them just can't handle their anger, and they turn to violence. We have to have safety first. The statistics on people who are killed and seriously injured through partner violence, intimate partner violence, are staggering, and we have a lot of work to do. But in no circumstances should anyone ever be confused about being safe and not accepting violence as a way of handling conflict or making decisions. There's no therapy on the planet that would allow that to happen or condone that.
I'd like to ask you something about the role of children in marital relationships and its effects. I'm sure that it's a kind of a complicated issue when it comes to having children and happiness, where people really are happy about having their children, but then when they measure happiness, when they're actually with their children, taking care of them and everything, they're less happy than when they're away from them. What would you say about the role of children in marriage?
Sure, you're absolutely right. Children are a blessing and a joy. No one can argue with that. But we do know, with years and years and years of research to back it up, that people's happiness in their relationship takes a pretty strong nosedive after the arrival of kids. People before they have kids, they have very high levels of satisfaction and happiness, but once the kids arrive, that drops quickly, and it keeps dropping with the birth of the children, and then it drops a little bit more when they're in preschool, then it drops a little bit more when they're school age and adolescence. And it actually hits its lowest point right about the time the kids leave for college. Okay, that's marital satisfaction. After the kids leave for college, it starts to take a sharp turn upward again. So if two people have managed to get through raising their kids and launching their kids, which of course we're not saying is a completely unpleasant process, it simply puts a lot of stress on our relationship. Let's think back to that soulmates to roommates time of a marriage where there's so much going on, people really don't have time to invest in their marriage and in each other. They should, and when they come to see me, they learn how to. But as a general rule, without changing anything, people just don't have enough time and energy to go around. so the marriage suffers. After the kids start to leave and are less dependent, people can rediscover themselves and rediscover their relationship and start doing that stuff that they couldn't get to before.
Wow, it just kind of goes against what society tells us. You know, society says, have kids, get married, have kids, and then the research says, when you have kids, your happiness goes down, so don't even think about it. And it's funny because I think about how people are going, you know, what everybody wants for their kids is to be happy. Every single parent wants their child to be happy. And then it wasn't until the introduction of positive psychology that we can now teach happiness somehow, somewhat. However, you know, the layperson, the regular Joe and Jane out there in the world don't know about positive psychology. And so we're not really taking advantage of all of this great information positive psychology has to offer and help get it into the family unit.
Well, you're right, and it is a huge, huge waste because people need this. You know, married couples and couples who are committed to each other face huge challenges. You know, we're all busy. We're multitasking all the time, and a lot of that is actual real-life demand that we actually can't get rid of. And we can learn how to respond to this life that offers us too much to do and not enough time by carving out time for serenity and happiness and for building ourselves and our partner up into a place where we nourish each other and we create a safe haven from all of the forces that would create chaos and tension and unhappiness, whether they're from outside the relationship. You guys were talking earlier about people who are out of work and are going to watch a lot of TV now. So the economics of our current situation can be a factor. And then, of course, having kids and all the stresses and things that go with that. Having parents who are getting older and require more care. All of these things are huge challenges, but the technology is there. The knowledge is there. And if we can get to couples and help them use the tools of positive psychology, savoring, appreciation, gratitude, forgiveness, the things that we know make a difference, we can not only affect their lives, but the lives of their kids and their grandkids. It can have a big impact.
I know we don't have a lot of time left, and maybe you could just say a couple words about something I find really just fascinating, and that is the issue of online infidelity.
Oh, yeah, okay. I'm happy to talk about that. It's really a tragic problem, actually, because you were talking about television earlier and that people are not as happy when they watch TV and or they're temporarily happy, but then their happiness goes down from watching a lot of TV. It's a lot of the same dynamic with online sex, okay? There's a lot of access to sexual relationships and emotionally intimate relationships, both through chat rooms and porn sites, but also things like two people each having a webcam over their computer and engaging in sexual behaviors with each other over the internet, you know, in 3D, you know, sight and sound and everything. I don't make any value judgment about those behaviors, but if either person is in a committed relationship, does it constitute infidelity if they're having sex with someone in virtual reality? There's no physical touching, but is it an affair? Well, most people would say it is, especially because there's something about online sex that's so compelling and so rewarding. when people have a sexual climax, all kinds of chemicals start charging through their brain, and it's tremendously rewarding, like a hit of a powerful drug. And that kind of reward then shapes people to keep going back. And having a relationship with a flesh and blood human being is vastly more complicated, and the rewards don't come as easily as with someone a couple thousand miles away, and you only connect sexually when you want to. It's hard for those two things, you know. It's a lot easier to do the online than it is to do the reality.
What has our world come to? Well, Elizabeth, can you please tell our listeners your contact information in case anyone would like to get a hold of you?
Certainly. And my website is www.caringcouples.com. That's one word, caring couples. And if you use my online contact form, I will send you some of the tips and tools that I use in my Accentuate for Couples program so that you can use them in your relationship and start building some positivity.
That's wonderful. Much needed, that's for sure. Well, we always invite our guests to join us in our fit of laughter as we come to the top of the hour here on Make Me Happy. Would you care to join us?
I would love to.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth, for all the good work you're doing. This is
Thank
Amy
you
Cozen.
So much. It was a real pleasure to interviewing you.
Thank you so much. Pleasure for me, too.
Thank you. It's Amy and Dr. Bob signing off. Bye for now.
Bye.